Okay. Oh, thank you. Yeah, I forgot. Oops. There it is. Okay. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu. Sahavidyan karavavahai tejasvinavadhitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shantihi chaitanyam sarvagam sarvam sarvaguhaguhashayam yat sarva vishayatitam Tasmai Sarva Vide Namaha. Om. Good. Nice to see you all today. Here we go. Welcome also to the many students attending this class regularly online. We continue in this very profound chapter 18 of of Shankara's Upadesha Sahasri, and where the topic has been and continues to be Pratibimba Vada. Do you think Shankara uses both Pratibimba Vada and Avacheda Vada, which we've discussed in other contexts? He uses both extensively, leading to the question, so which one is right? We've had this discussion before. Do you have the right answer in your mind? Neither of them are right. They're both metaphors. A metaphor is not the thing. These are explanations. These are prakriyas, teaching methodologies. So please, you see, if you go looking at the more intellectual kinds of discussions that you'll find on the internet about Advaita Vedanta, you'll see this particular argument, which one is right. And it really shows that, sadly, people don't understand what Vedanta is about. Vedanta is about helping you understand your own experience, because your own experience is misunderstood by you. Present in your experience right now is Satchidananda Atma, vast, limitless, full and complete, but it's not recognized as such. Even though it's present here, now, in this experience, it goes unrecognized. So we have extensive teachings, especially these teachings of Shankara, to help us correctly understand what we're experiencing right now. Now, it's a very profound inquiry. So let us pick up the thread where we continue with Avacheda Vada. I'm sorry, Pratibimba Vada.
Adarshanuvidhayatvam, Adarshanuvidhayatvam, Chayaya asyate muke, Chayaya asyate muke, Buddhi dharmanukaritvam, Buddhi dharmanukaritvam, Nyabhasasyatateshyate.
Nice place to begin our class today with a very simple restatement of the Pratibimba Vada. And simply, before we see Shankara's language here, very simply, just like a mirror reflects your face, your mind reflects consciousness. That's it. It's not that complicated. Of course, when we look into it, we see lots of interesting factors. So the mirror reflects your face. The face you see in the mirror is not you. You're on the other side of the mirror. In the same way, the consciousness reflected in your mind, and this we have to do this because this expression starts out being so abstract for most people. Consciousness reflected in your mind means experience. That's all. What you're experiencing right now is consciousness reflected in your mind. So don't get hung up on the complexity. How can consciousness be reflected? Is the mind shiny? And we have all these silly questions. It's a metaphor. There's no reflection. There's no shininess. It's a metaphor that helps us understand our experience. Now, the significance of that metaphor then is how it's used to help us understand our experience. And that's what Shankara refers to here. He says, starting with the second line, chayayaha, for the reflection. Chaya here doesn't mean shadow, it means reflection. For the reflection, and obviously the reflection of consciousness, the reflection of consciousness in your mind, he says, that reflection, adarsha, anuvidhayatvam. Shankara uses very precise language, but it means that you have to unpack it, so to speak. Anuvidhayatvam means when something abides. And what's abiding in the reflection is adarsha, is the qualities of the mirror. Anuvidhaya means that which persists. It's a complicated way of saying something very obvious, and that is, when you look into the mirror, the qualities of the mirror, asyate, to finish up the words here, asyate, are projected, appear, mukhe, in the face in the mirror. And what that means is if the mirror is tinted, suppose the mirror is tinted orange. I like that color. So you look in the mirror and you see an orange face, right? How about if the mirror is distorted, warped? You look in the mirror and you'll see a distorted, warped face. By the way, I've used these two examples intentionally. You'll see that in the second half. So, in technical terms, the qualities of the quality of orangeness and distortion belong to the mirror or your face. But what's significant is you see them. Do you see them in the mirror or do you see them in your face? You don't see, in fact, you're not really looking at them when you use a mirror. I never thought about this. When you're using a mirror, are you looking at the mirror or looking at your face? Right? You don't pay attention to the mirror normally. You're paying attention to your face. So then the tinted quality, the orangeness of the mirror, and the warpedness of the mirror, you see it in your face. You experience it in your face, this face, because you're not differentiating between that face and this face. So you think, well, I look very orange today. That happens. It can happen, right? So this is the strength of the metaphor, is to show how these imperfections that belong to your mind, the limitations which belong to your mind, the problems which belong to your mind, are constantly superimposed on your true nature, consciousness. Satchidananda Atma, that so-called inner divinity, which has no limitations, has no problems, has no defects. So this, you can see the power of this metaphor to address a very fundamental issue in Advaita Vedanta. Then in the second half of the verse, Shankara goes on, we go from the drishtanta to the darshtanta. Drishtanta is a metaphor, and darshtanta is what the metaphor represents. So darshtanta in the second half. So just as the properties, just as the properties of the mirror that appear in the reflection are attributed to the face, in the same way, you see that word tata, second to last word in the verse, tata ishyate tata, in the same way, buddhi dharma anukaritvam. Notice how it sounds like adarsha anuvidhayatvam, parallel. So these parallel structures are used a lot in Sanskrit verses and in Vedantic teaching. So here, buddhi dharma anukaritvam, the properties that abide, here dharma means be careful. Dharma doesn't have anything to do with ethics or morality here. Buddhi dharma means what? Quality of the mind, characteristic of the mind. The word dharma is used frequently in that sense. You've heard me say the dharma of water is to be wet and cool. It's used frequently in that sense. Get ready for that. So buddhi dharma means the qualities of the mind, the qualities which are anukaritvam, which persist gnya abhasasya in the abhasa, in the reflection of gnya. Here means consciousness, chit. So the reflection of consciousness means what? What you're experiencing right this moment. In that experience is superimposed, tata ishyate, there is, buddhi dharma anukaritvam. The properties of your mind are present in your experience right now. That seems obvious, right? The properties of your mind are present in your experience right now. But here's a question. Do those properties belong to you, the experiencer, or do those properties belong to mind? Very clearly, they belong to the mind. Look at the consequence. We gave the examples of tinted orange tint and warped mirror. So suppose your mind is tinted with sadness. The sadness belongs to your mind, but it's present in your experience right now. And it seems to affect you. But when the mirror is tinted and you see an orange face, is your face orange at all? Any trace of orangeness in your face? Unless you're a certain president who likes orange makeup. Sorry, I couldn't resist. I shouldn't do that, but somehow. Anyway. The orangeness you see in the face belongs to the mirror, but you wrongly attribute it to your face. In the same way, the sadness that belongs to your mind gets wrongly attributed to you. You own the sadness. You don't own the sadness. It belongs to your mind. The other example I gave is a warped mirror. You look in the image is all distorted. Suppose your mind right now is agitated. Probably not, but suppose. So if your mind is agitated, what is present in your experience right now, in addition to everything else you're experiencing, you're also experiencing agitation. So you're experiencing the stuff outside, you're simultaneously experiencing the stuff inside, the agitation, and it gets all mixed up in your experience. Again, the agitation belongs, just as the distortion of your face belongs, the quality of being distorted belongs to the mirror. In the same way, the quality or the quality of agitation belongs to your mind. This is such a powerful Vedantic teaching because, first of all, because Vedanta ultimately is not a philosophical study of anything, but rather it's a teaching that helps you come out of suffering. And the main reason we suffer is everything seems to affect us. We seem hypersensitive. Whatever is happening around us in the room seems to affect us. Whatever is happening in our bodies seems to affect us. Whatever is happening in our mind seems to affect us. Back to my bad jokes. Whatever is happening in Washington, D.C. seems to affect us. Whatever is happening in Russia seems to affect us. Whatever is happening in Ukraine seems to affect us. Whatever is happening in Gaza seems to affect us. We seem hypersensitive. Everything seems to affect us. And we are especially aware of when we're affected negatively. And when we're affected negatively, we suffer. Suppose that came to an end. Suppose you looked in that mirror and you understand the orange tint of the face, of your face, the orange tint is a mirror appearance and it's present because of a problem of the mirror. It's not your problem, the mirror's problem. In the same way, when you see the distortion, you know that your face is fine. This face is fine. This face is distorted, fine. But this face is okay. Notice, this face is okay in spite, this is such a crucial statement, listen carefully. This face is okay in spite of the orangeness and distortedness of that face. Now, that's the drishtanta. What is the darshtanta? Your true nature, as pure consciousness, is okay in spite of the problems manifest in this experience. The problems manifest in this experience don't belong to you. They belong to your mind. When you get this, it completely transforms how you relate to the world around you, to the world inside you, to experience. So this is the power of that metaphor, this pratibimbavada. Okay, Shankara now extends this a little bit. Buddhestu pratyayastasmat, buddhestu pratyayastasmat, atma bhasena dipitaha, atma bhasena dipitaha, grahaka hiva bhasante, grahaka hiva bhasante, dahanti volmuk ol. I'm sorry. Dahanti volmukhadayaha. Dahanti volmukhadayaha. The word is ulmukha. You have to dig the word out. Ulmukha. Okay. tasmat, therefore. And Shankara here is now going on to the next step. Based on everything we've seen so far, tasmat, therefore, we now make the next logical step. And the next logical step is based on the fact, he doesn't say it explicitly, you have to get it out of context, is this whole metaphor depends on the word I've used several times, this proximity. Only when that mirror is properly positioned at a near distance, then and only then do you get that reflection. So that proximity is crucial. If the mirror is distant, there's no reflection. If the mirror is, to use the American expression, in your face, then you get the reflection. Now, what that means is there is proximity, closeness, nearness between mind and consciousness. Right? So remember, this face represents mind. I'm sorry. This face represents consciousness. The mirror represents mind. And the mirror in the face is reflected consciousness. So let's not lose sight of the basis of this metaphor. But notice for the face to appear in the mirror, there has to be proximity between the mirror and the face. For experience to occur, there has to be proximity between consciousness and mind. What is the distance between consciousness and mind? Consciousness being all pervasive, the distance is zero. So we say the mind is pervaded by consciousness. Because of that proximity, that's why there's this interchange between mind and consciousness, this interchange of qualities. And now Shankara is going to put a little different spin on it here, and that is not only because of proximity, not only do, and we saw this maybe two classes ago, not only do we attribute the qualities of the mirror, orangeness, distortedness, we attribute the qualities of the mirror to this face, wrongly, but we also, when you look in the mirror, you say, that's me. It's not you, it's a reflection. But you say, that's me, so now you're attributing this face to the mirror. Works both ways. Remember we called that anyonya adhyasa? Adhyasa, superimposition, anyonya, mutual, bidirectional. So we attribute the attributes of the mirror to the face, we attribute the attributes of your mind to consciousness, and vice versa. We attribute the I-ness of this face to the reflection. In the same way, or you say it's in the mirror, I am in the mirror. In the same way, we attribute the nature of consciousness, sentiency, is wrongly attributed to the mind. Instead of using all this language, let's see how Shankara presents it here. He says, tasmat, because of this proximity, buddhehi tu pratyayaha tu. Specifically speaking, the pratyayaha, the activities, buddhehi, of the mind. And here we're not distinguishing between buddhi and manas, so we just use simply the word mind. So the activities of the mind, atma abhasena, since those activities are abhasa, they are reflections of atma, consciousness. So the activities of the mind, experience, right? What you're experiencing right now, since what you're experiencing right now, all these experiences, especially thoughts, let's go with that, thoughts. It's not necessarily. So all the activities of your mind, atma abhasena, because they are reflections of consciousness, experience, what do we say? Experience is a reflection in the mind, a reflection of what? Consciousness. So, because all your mental activities, all experience are a reflection of consciousness, for that reason, they shine. They appear, in the next line, bhasante, they shine, they appear grahakaha eva. Now this word grahaka, that which grasps, and it's an agent noun, so it suggests that this is, our minds have the power of grasping, our minds have the power of understanding, our minds have the power of perception. And here's the problem. Yeah. How about this? I like this explanation. When you see your face in the mirror, you not only see the shape, the form, the visual part of the, but when you blink your eyes, it blinks back at you. If you talk, it seems to be talking. It seems to be functioning like a conscious being. It's not just a static image like a painting. It seems very real. It seems like another sentient being. There's a duplicate of you. One of you is here, and what is that? A mini me is present in the mirror. It seems like a second person. And that's the metaphor, Shankara, that's the aspect of the metaphor Shankara means to bring out right now. And that is, because your mind is pervaded by consciousness and therefore reflects consciousness, the nature of that consciousness gets mixed up with the activities of your mind, and the activities of your mind seem sentient. Seem filled with consciousness. Is there any sentiency in this reflection? Sentiency means the power to know. That's the literal meaning of the word sentiency. The ability to know, to be a conscious being. The image in the mirror is just an image. It doesn't do... does it blink? It doesn't do anything. It's just an image. In the same way, the thoughts, the mental activities, he uses the term pratyaya, the activities taking place in your mind seem dipitaha, they seem brilliant. You get a thought. What a great idea. That's maybe not a good example, but the thought seems to be very real, very full of knowledge. And that's an illusion. Shankara is going to explain it using several metaphors, two metaphors. So let me give the first... Actually, beforehand, let me put it like this. The life that you see in the image doesn't belong to the image. It's borrowed from you. In the same way, the intelligence of your mind, intelligence in the sense of consciousness, is borrowed from you. The image has borrowed life, and the activities of your mind have borrowed consciousness, the consciousness that belongs to you. So the metaphor, Shankara didn't give this metaphor, but it's commonly used. Does the moon shine? Not always. There are several days during the month it doesn't shine. So the moon doesn't shine on its own. It borrows the light of the sun. So the shining nature of the full moon is not a property of the moon. The moon has borrowed the light of the sun. So this is a metaphor to say that your thoughts, which seem so brilliant, have borrowed consciousness from you. Shankara here gives a different metaphor. He says, Eva, you have to break the words apart, dahanti, Eva, ulmukadayaha, ulmuka, again, a torch. So he says, Eva, just like ulmuka, etc., just as torches, etc., dahanti, they burn, they shine. Here's the idea. If you have a torch and it is burning, that burning has both light and heat. Are light and heat inherent in a torch? Just like light is not inherent in the moon, the light of the moon is borrowed light. The light and heat of a torch are borrowed. They don't belong to the torch. And what that metaphor shows is that the mind is not in and of itself conscious. And there is an explanation that we use all the time, but it happens to be a bogus explanation. Let me give you the bogus explanation. The mind, in the absence of consciousness, is inert. The mind, in the absence of consciousness, is inert. Now, that seems to be so. The reason I say bogus is that statement violates several laws of logic. So I'm just pointing out just some of the subtlety and difficulty of the subject matter. The mind in the absence of consciousness, if you use an argument which is based on an impossibility, suppose the earth were made of jello, then, wait a minute, what kind of argument is that? It's not possible for the earth to be made of jello, so any argument based on that supposition is not going to be very convincing. And here's the problem when we say that the mind in the absence of consciousness, mind is thoughts. In a simple definition, what is mind? Mind is thoughts. Can there be a thought without consciousness? This is a point. So this is a little subtle bit of logic. But yet we say that all the time. I just want to point out that it's logically weak. What Shankara is giving us here is not logically weak. He is giving us a powerful metaphor. No, Shankara would never say the mind in the absence of consciousness is inert. He won't say that because it's a logically flawed expression. Instead of saying that, he gives us this metaphor. He says, light and heat are not properties of the torch, but it looks so. when the torch is shining. In the same way, consciousness is not a property of the mind, but it looks like that. So notice Shankara here is using a metaphor. And this metaphor is not defective in the sense that all metaphors are defective, right? All metaphors are not the actual thing. The metaphor is a tool of understanding. So at least Shankara here is not being careless with logic. He uses this metaphor. And he says that like the moon borrows the light of the sun, like the torch borrows the light and heat of fire. So light doesn't belong to the moon. Light and heat don't belong to the torch. In the same way, the mind figuratively borrows consciousness. Consciousness is not inherent in the mind any more than light and heat are inherent in the torch. So it's a powerful metaphor used many times. In fact, Shankara is going to use it one more time in the next verse. I'm sorry?
For online slide.
Online. Yeah. Oh, yeah, thank you. Good. For our online viewers, one of my students just pointed out that I've been depriving you of these slides. I apologize for that. Thank you for pointing that out. You know, these slides are available on our website. So just go to our website, go to this Upadesha Sahasri, and you'll find this PDF, and then you can follow along. Thank you for mentioning that. Okay. So, we'll just see this one more verse today. Notice the prior verse was verse 71. Now we've suddenly jumped to verse 83, and I said that for this chapter, Chapter 18 being over 200 verses long and being highly technical, we're taking the liberty to jump over parts where we don't break the continuity of thought, and we jump over certain topics because you might not be ready for those topics. The topic we're jumping over here is a refutation of two of the four main schools of Buddhism, the refutation of Shunyavada and Vijnanavada. Mostly Shankara focuses in this text on Vijnanavada. If you don't know the four main schools of Buddhism and you don't know what is Mahayana and Theravada, in fact, Shankara doesn't even bother with Theravada, if all of the details of each of these schools of Buddhism, if that's not well known to you, then going through Shankara's refutation won't be very meaningful. So for that reason, we're taking the liberty to skip only those portions, and you'll find surprisingly how, when you see the next verse, how it seems to really fall in line. Shankara is very skillful. You know how sometimes speakers go on a, you know, when you're talking, you go on a detour, a tangent. Well, Shankara does so in the refutation of the Buddhists, but then he very skillfully comes back to the main topic, and you'll see that in this verse.
Adrishir drishi rupena bhati buddhir yada sada bhati buddhir yada sada pratyaya hapitasya syus pratyaya hapitasya syus tapayo vispulingavata tapo yo vispulingavata tapas ayas vispulingavat.
We have to break the words apart. We'll see that in a few minutes. Okay. At the top, actually, in the middle of the second line, find the word buddhi. Buddhi, mind. That's the subject of our sentence. That buddhi, which is, in the first line, a drishihi. Drishi means observer, consciousness. But buddhi is a drishi. It is not conscious. Why? Because it borrows consciousness. The moon is not self-shining. The torch is not self-shining. In the same way, buddhi is not self-shining. The moon borrows light. The torch borrows light. Mind, buddhi, borrows light. Therefore, buddhihi is adrishihi. It doesn't shine on its own, but rather, drishi rupena bhati. It bhati, it appears, drishi rupena, as though it is consciousness. So the moon doesn't have light, but it shines. The torch is not innately bright, but it shines and it burns. In the same way, the buddhi itself does not possess consciousness, but it borrows that consciousness, it reflects. Like the moon reflects the light of the sun, buddhi reflects the light of consciousness, and therefore it shines. Now, and it shines sada, always shining. The moon... This shows the flaw of the moon metaphor. Does the moon always shine? No. Does the buddhi always shine? Well, that's a little complicated. Depends on what you mean by shine. Is consciousness sometimes present and sometimes absent in the mind? It is always present in the mind. For that reason, Shankara says, sada. That consciousness is always present in the mind, always reflected in the mind. Now, there's a problem here with deep sleep, by the way, which we'll take up in next week's class. In deep sleep, can we save that for next week? Here's the question. You can ponder it. I'll give you a whole week. Does your mind reflect consciousness in deep sleep? Does the mind reflect consciousness in deep sleep? It's subtle, tricky. They're actually different ways of interpreting that. Why don't we save that discussion for next week, because that is the opening topic of the next verse, and that's really not our topic right here. So that's we'll leave that pending for now. So here what he said is that what Shankara has said is that consciousness is not a property of the mind. The mind gains its sentiency from consciousness. It borrows consciousness, it reflects consciousness. Shankara now says, yada, when this is a fact is very abstract, so I prefer when this is understood, then pratyayaha tasyaha of the mind, the pratyayaha, the activities of the mind, and I'll go over this whole thing again to make it more clear. Then when you understand that the buddhi is not innately conscious, but rather the buddhi borrows consciousness, so to speak, from the mind. Yada, when this is true, and when this is understood, then tasyaha, you understand that for the mind, pratyayaha, the activities of the mind are tapas, ayas, vispulingavat. They are vat-like. Like what? Vispulinga sparks. What kind of sparks? Sparks which come from tapta. I mistranslated it before. Not tapas, tapta. Heated ayas. Ayas is iron. Tapta ayas, this is a metaphor used many times. Heated metal. Remember in ancient times, down the street was a blacksmith. Right? And we don't live in that kind of world. In fact, just a couple of hundred years ago, we would have lived in that world. Down the street is a blacksmith, very important. And what does a blacksmith do? Puts the iron in the furnace until it's red hot, and then takes it and forms whatever names needs to be formed. So this is a very common metaphor in ancient cultures, and it's pretty much lost in modern times. So here's the point. When that iron is glowing red, and even the spulinga is even, in fact, when you hit it, the sparks come off. So this is a metaphor that Shankara is using. The sparks coming off of that red hot iron and the red shine of that iron, what color is iron? Red? No. So that redness is borrowed. This is the metaphor. One more time. Redness is not inherent in the iron. Heat is not inherent in the iron. These sparks are not inherent. They're bright. These bright sparks are not inherent in the iron. They are borrowed. So another powerful metaphor to show that the activities of your mind, which seem so conscious. Let's end with just one more. Let's try to put a little different twist on it. Right now, we're having this experience. Definitely, it's a conscious experience. There's no such thing as an unconscious experience. But now the question is, where does that consciousness come from? Now, it is so common, you would say, well, the experience is taking place in my mind, so that consciousness must come from my mind. This is modern materialism, very simply put. The modern scientific materialistic standpoint is that somehow consciousness is produced by your brain and or mind. They've been saying that for a long time. They're still unable to prove it. And a few of them are beginning to recognize they're in trouble, and maybe it's not provable from this, using the tools of science. A few of them are figuring out that science is not capable of proving or disproving the fact that their hypothesis that consciousness is born of the brain. So eventually, in my opinion, they will learn, possibly during our lifetimes, I don't know. Few of them are getting close. But eventually they're going to have to concede that the tools of science are not capable of proving or disproving their hypothesis that consciousness is a product of the brain. They're not, most of them are not there yet. They're still trying and trying and trying to show how consciousness emerges from stuff. You can see the difficulty they face. But they're really trying, and they got some powerful theories going on. But the question is, can these theories be proven? And in my opinion, there are structural reasons that science will never be capable of proving that hypothesis. Eventually, they're going to have to give up. So here's where we're left then. If consciousness is present in this experience, and if that consciousness, not if, since that consciousness can't come from inert things like brain, mind, where does that consciousness come? Consciousness is present in this experience here and now. But it's not produced by the brain and or mind. That's why this idea of borrowed consciousness is so important. Reflected consciousness. This consciousness is you. This consciousness is the nature of the observer, which is why we use the metaphor that you, your consciousness, another metaphor, your consciousness as though illumines the activities of your mind. It's yet another metaphor. But notice it's attributing the illumination not to the thoughts. Our thoughts self, is the moon self-shining, self-revealing? No. Is the torch self-shining, self-revealing? No. Our thoughts self-shining, self-revealing? No. They are illumined by consciousness. Consciousness shines on the thoughts metaphorically, reveals them, just as sunlight shines on the moon. So these are wonderful metaphors. They help us understand our experience, but don't forget, they are metaphors. And this is what sets Vedanta apart from philosophy, as properly understood, and science. Philosophy is looking for a truth out there. And here we're looking in here, and in here consciousness is already present, so we don't need to define or prove that consciousness. We just need to understand it better. And that's why we use these powerful metaphors in Vedanta. We'll see more in our next class. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinah, sarve santu niramayah, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchid dukha bhag bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityorma amritangamaya. Om shanti shanti shantihi. Om tat sat.
Very good.